Jim Taylor back on the WMJ Sports Line on this Saturday morning. Pleased to have John Elder in studio with us. And, of course, we all know Coach Elder's great resume. Now currently with the Illinois Coaches Association, the Executive Secretary. Good morning, sir. Always great to see you. Well, let's back up. I know, a couple of weeks removed from the Illinois Football Coaches Association Spring Clinic. That's always the big weekend for the coaches gathering. I assume that's a pretty fun time for you because I see a lot of familiar faces.
I enjoy it. That you know and so forth, and we had a better clinic this year in many ways. We didn't have as great attendance as we'd like, but we had reasonable attendance this year. And we had Sean Payton was our headline speaker, and he did a great job, and the coaches really enjoyed him. And pardon me, and they attended the sessions very much. We have about 60 speakers throughout the 3 days, and most of the sessions were pretty full.
And most of it. That people don't realize, most of it deals with, you know, strategy sessions, those type of things, different speakers. I mean, it's jam-packed. It's like continuing education for high school football coaches, basically, right?
No question about it. And it gives high school coaches like to listen to high school coaches when it comes to, and everyone's got a different idea, and those ideas you can pick up from anyone. We also have college coaches that speak, but the high school coaches are the ones that really make it go.
Well, I know one of the big issues heading into the clinic, a year ago and now this year again, and I think some of the Big Ten schools have backed off on it, is, you know, they said, we're going to play some, and I think it's a Big Ten network-driven initiative, and it's not really a specific school-driven initiative. However, the schools kind of have to preach the party line a little bit, but I think Coach Fitzgerald said, no, we're not. We don't want to do it. I don't care what the Big Ten says, and that's playing college football games on Friday nights. And I know we're, you know, our relationship with the Illinois radio network, we're like, and all the affiliates with the Illinois Radio Network, don't you realize that basically every one of them have Friday night high school football games on? So from your affiliation standpoint that way with the local markets, you're not getting your product on.
No question about
it. Dumb idea, wasn't it?
Oh, well, we think so. You know, this has been a problem since it started, and I've been with groups at every level, nationally and locally and statewide and so forth, that have appealed to the coaches and appealed to the schools on Friday night football, but it's a dollar-driven thing. There's no question about that, and I guess I'm a little stubborn. During the high school football season, I don't care who's on Friday night. I don't watch that. I go to high school games.
Amen.
But everyone in
Preach.
That way.
Well, and then can you shed this, and maybe I shouldn't even ask this, because I think my brother-in-law, Pat Lohr, coached at Fulton when Beckman was still the coach at Illinois. When he got up, I think, and began the clinic, what was a year ago, wasn't it, right? Or was it 2 years
two
ago?
2 years ago, yeah.
And talked about Friday night football, and basically your response was, why in the world are you doing that?
Yeah, well, you know, we contend with many things, particularly in small school football, and even in the larger areas. When you take in Champaign, the Champaign schools alone have to suffer tremendously if Illinois has a high school or a Friday night football game. And as it turned out, their home game that year, if you remember right, they had a rainstorm and so forth, and it was canceled. They played the next day, so they didn't really gain anything by it. But now this year, the University of Illinois is playing two games on Friday night. And it's a problem. It's a problem universally. But to this point, the dollars went out is what it really boils down to. And, yes, it is. It's a driven thing, but they've bought into it, too. Many of them really haven't pushed back from it, let's say, and have made it just part of their routine.
You know, I know the weekend is also the Illinois High School Football Coaches Association Hall of Fame. They have that. Now, I mean, two local guys connected to you. Tim Lafferty played for you and Alexis Kidd down at Illini West. He was inducted, coached at Northwestern La Harpe, of course, now at Illini West. And then, of course, Coach Tim Engebretson at Warren, now United, and I think they're having a reception for him locally today down in Monmouth. So what about, you know, when you get a chance to be part of that, that's got to
be
pretty neat.
Well, it's a nice ceremony. We have it. It's always the culmination of the clinic. It's Saturday noon. We have a nice luncheon, and it's a good program. We have, and this year was exciting. Yeah, Tim played for us, and Tim's he's a coach. That's what it really boils down to. He's coached at five different schools and lived in the same house, you know, which is kind of unique. But still, through the consolidations and the co-ops and so forth, he's worked different places. Always been very intense. He was very intense as a player. I'm confident he's very intense as a coach and does things the right way and has his priorities in the right order, no question about it. And Tim Ingebretson, Tim, obviously such a nice young fella, and things went well for him at Warren when he went over there, and he was also the basketball coach, if you remember right, to start with, and worked there and blended in the two communities and the two groups of youngsters together, and was able to maintain a very successful program throughout.
When we announced on social media earlier this week about, you know, who our guest was going to be on Sportsline this week, one of the first retweets I got was from Joe Blinboom, who coaches at Deer Creek Mackinac, an Aledo kid, and
right.
Officially the last ever head football coach at Alexis.
That's right.
So, you know, and he said must-listen radio. So he knows the importance and the legacy of John Elder.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what does it mean when you... And you run into people like that, you know, at the clinics, and you go to the state championship football games every year. So, you know, those relationships, I guess, maybe some people don't understand behind the scenes. That's the neat thing I tell people about probably the coaching tree and the relationships you develop with coaching.
No question about it. And that's what, you know, when people ask me at times as to why I stay involved, and I tell them, it keeps me around people I like to be around. As a matter of fact, you mentioned Job. The Football Coach Association also honors the state championship coaches and runner-up coaches with a ring or a watch and so forth that they're choosing. And I visited with Job just momentarily last weekend at the clinic because obviously he had took the team. And again, it was exciting to watch his team play because they played football the way you should play football, as far as I'm concerned. They were very successful at it. And so I know he's worked hard over there at Deer Creek Mackinac. He followed Jim McDonald, who had a great program there, and they struggled a year or two with some young people, but they've come back and maintain a very strong program again.
And I know they had a referendum in November, and I don't know even know if it passed or not in regards to facility improvements, but I'm like, man, when I went, because I did the Orion game they played down there, and I thought, like, their setup at DMAC, I mean, it's like, if you call it, like, for the home team, it's the friendly confines, but for the visiting team, the unfriendly confines, because basically... The school is kind of parallel to the one side of the field where there's basically just a driveway between almost the sideline and the school, and then the other side is a very restricted area with a press box, very little seating. It's more stand around the field. I thought it's kind of a great small school environment.
Well, I've never been there. United played them one year down there, but I was involved somewhere else, and my understanding is that some of the radio people broadcast out of the window from the school.
Yeah, they do. He let us in the main press box for some reason, but that's what it is, like
what
a library.
Yeah, and I understand it is unique, and that's the thing about small school football is the fact that the people are there and they're on top of the football, on top of the field, and the youngsters enjoy that and the people enjoy it, and that's what it should be about. And, you know, there's nothing like a Friday night at a small school football game.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, when you look at the clinic and the conversation you have, is there a big hot button topic right now? You know, we always talk about, like, playoff classification. That's an issue.
Yeah.
I know the concussion stuff is going to continue to pick up steam, it sounds like, every year.
That's the big thing now and has been for a few years. But it's starting to come back a little bit, not that people aren't. They're protecting themselves, to be quite honest with you, and working hard to avoid that type of thing. And you know, it from the standpoint of an old coach, it's been blown out of proportion anyway, because people think that everyone plays high school football like those people on Sunday, and they don't. You know, if they would just learn to bend at the waist a little bit when they make a tackle, they would take care of a lot of that concussion thing, really. And that's the difference when high school youngsters and those pro people. But and it gets a lot of publicity that way. The big thing usually, and now again, is the scheduling thing for people. You know, there's so many closed conferences now that have no rooms for non-conference games, and consequently, many people are really struggling to get games. I see where Galesburg, of course, being in a six-team league, that opens up 4 weeks of games. I see Galesburg's playing a team out of Missouri this year. They played a team from Michigan last year. Rock Island struggled for games. They've tried to get crossovers with other conferences, and some of it's worked, some of it hasn't. But it's just kind of the nature of the beast.
Yeah, when you talk about, you know, the headline issue for football is the concussion issue, and I tell people the most vicious hit my son ever took playing high school football was in 7-on-7. It wasn't padded football, and I wish it would have been padded football because he wouldn't have suffered the injury, because a lot of those crossing routes they run in 7-on-7 at, you know, a lot of those kids without pads, the warp speed they run at, and then they hit one another, like with a knee that comes up when you're making a catch trying to tuck the ball, and he took one right in the head, and I thought he got knocked out.
Yeah.
We were over at Rock Island. I'm like, man. So, yeah, things of that nature. But scheduling, for me, and I don't know if it's just a situation of because where we're at in Western Illinois and the changing demographic and the declining population base and the declining enrollment base in schools, and it seems like it's always just it's a one domino. It's one school going from one conference to another, and then that creates this upheaval. I don't remember. Were you, you know, the district scheduling? I can't remember if you were supportive of that. And I know everybody will say you can't do it up in the Chicagoland area, and that's, I guess, the issue with football. Like everything, one thing can't apply to all the schools, apparently.
And with the playoff structure, in many ways, it probably has to. And yes, the larger suburban schools are adverse to it because they can play. Most of them, except the DuPage Valley, who's probably the strongest football coach in the state conference in the state, they struggle to get games because of their strength of their teams. And other than that, those people can. You know, they could meet at the game site, so to speak, with their youngsters because they might not play a game that's more than 6 or 7 miles away from them all year, just based on the way it is up there. But it's a problem. There's no question about it. I want to interject. You mentioned 7-on-7. I'll tell you my 7-on-7 story. We were never involved in 7-on-7s or whatever, and finally, one year, they had a 7-on-7 tournament the same at Illinois Wesleyan the same day as our high school all-star game when we were at ISU. And so our kids wanted to go, and so I said, okay, we'll go. So it was about 100 degrees that day, and I took 7 kids to a 7-on-7. Well, admittedly, by the time the day was over, they were totally swamped.
Yeah.
But I'd never been around it and hadn't paid much attention to it.
Well, and this is my opinion. It's overkill now. In my opinion, 7-on-7 is overkill.
Yeah.
And the only thing that I'll say that I'm not saying from a I understand from a coaching standpoint for coaches that they, especially the teams that run passing attacks with timing and all that, I think that's pretty important. But I always look at it as a false sense of security, maybe, from some of the kids that say, man, we had a pretty good 7-on-7 season.
Yeah.
Well, what does that mean? I thought kind of a couple of years my son, I thought, and I even thought as a parent, man, we had a pretty good 7-on-7 season. I think we might be pretty decent. But, oh, that's right, on week one, they put pads on and we have to block somebody, which is and I guess that's how, you know, those programs or how the kids need to comprehend what it actually means
right.
in the off season.
And I think probably looking at it from a coaching standpoint, and I would say that your defensive backs get as much out of it as anybody, probably, if you go about it the proper way. And I just have never been very much associated with it, so I know that, like you say, I everyone does it now, and they have nationwide things and all that sort of thing, and the ESPNs and the Nikes and all those people get involved in it, and so consequently it becomes more attractive to people because of that.
Well, and the I think the other big thing is because, you know, off-season stuff is still pretty big, and it's always interesting when I even talk to coaches, the kind of pull they have of, you know, how should they approach the off-season? Are they doing too much? Are they not doing enough?
Yeah. Well,
I mean, that's the debate, and I just think now some of the off-season, I believe the strength and conditioning stuff is important, not just for football, but for all schools.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the, and maybe this is just me getting older, but I just think a lot of the off-season stuff, you know, with actual games and competitions, yeah. I really think it's overkill and you don't need to do it.
Well, it depends, you know. Excuse me. Let's face it. Youngsters from this area and the smaller schools, they're the high majority of them, football career is going to end when they graduate from high school. And theoretically, that involvement that they do in the summertime and so forth, they also get a little tired of it, I'm sure. And the coaches, they do it because the next guy does it, I guess you'd say. And it's kind of evolved into a thing where, you know, I always said that this came after my coaching days. We never had anything in the summertime. We had the weight room was unlocked where youngsters could go to the weight room if they wanted to, but they went in and out on their own, so to speak. But it's just become a thing where you've got to be involved or people think you're lazy as a coach, you know, and that's not the case. But it wasn't worth that much to me as a coach to spend all summer doing that because I was around the youngsters every day and they needed a break. I always thought a young high school boy needed a chance to play baseball and chase girls or whatever in the summertime rather than fooling around with basketball or football or whatever.
Yeah.
That's an old man's opinion.
Well, but that's when I get back to the coaching kind of life, or the coaching lifeline, or the career, in terms of, you know, back in the 70s, maybe the rule was you spent 30 years coaching. You know, maybe you go to the 90s, it's 20 years. Now I think if you get 10 years at one place, that's, you know, you're doing something. But I think a lot of that has to do with the changing culture. But I think a lot of kind of the length of coaching, I think a lot of that is shortened on average because of the off-season stuff.
No question.
You're not really coaching a year per se. You're coaching more than a year in your sport because of the stuff that must go on after the actual season.
No question about it. And your time commitment is just there. It's just that simple. And, of course, you know, excuse me, let's face it, the bottom line isn't dollars and cents for coaches, but it still amounts to something. And coaches are putting in twice as much time, at least, as they ever did for the same amount of money. Going back, and of course this was in the prehistoric days, but I remember the first year that I coached as an assistant coach, I got $200 for being the high school assistant football coach, and we had 11 days of double practices before school ever started. You know, we'd put in many, many hours, you know, if we figured it on a per-hour basis, it would have been nothing. And that was before, like I say, before we ever started a game.
Yeah. So basically, that sounded like you lost money on that.
No question about it. No question about it. But that's the way with schools and activities now, in the same way with the athletic directors, for instance. That's a burden on these people at schools because they've got so many activities. And there's one person that's responsible for taking care of the supervision, et cetera, and all the day-to-day things that go down. And it's understandable why people don't stay in it. You know, young coaches, and let's face it, you know, young coaches are married to young women. And young ladies don't like to spend all their time by themselves, so to speak. And when you get one that does, as a coach, you're pretty darn lucky. And that also takes people away from the profession because of their married life.
Your first year was when? You said your first
1962.
And it was out of the Lexus?
Out of Lexus. That's my first year. I taught 1 year at Mineral Grade School.
Now that's
in the Anawan District now. I had my first coaching teaching job. I had two contracts offered to me, and they were both from school. Only two schools in Illinois that closed their high schools that spring. One was at LaRose, Illinois, and the other was at Mineral.
So LaRose is where?
LaRose is over by Low Point, Washburn, Toluca, in that area.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So did you grow? You grew up in Lexus?
Yes,
or no?
I did. I went to high school.
So who did you coach with, like in 1962? Who were some?
Well,
of the names?
Bob Hauser was the head football coach, and I coached with him until then. When he took over as principal, I took over as football coach, and then he got killed in an auto accident that next winter, and so. But no, and another thing about coaching, and though when we first started, you know, you had two coaches, and one guy was head coach of all sports, and somebody was assistant, or one guy was assistant in one sport and head coach in another. So you worked with the same people all year, and you just knew what the other person was going to do all the time, and that helped from the coaching standpoint as well, because you didn't have to have days and days of meetings and so forth, because you knew what was going to happen, then they knew what was going to happen.
So that's like the Ed Harris movie in radio, how the coaches reversed roles. One was the football coach, Ed Harris, and then he was the assistant during
that's the way it was in those days.
So you officially became a head coach then the following year?
No, I became a head coach in 1966, I think.
66.
It was. No, that's not right. Would have been 65.
So the question I beg of you, could you coach in today's environment if you were a 27-year-old John Elder like you were in 19?
No, probably not.
Why not?
Well, I'd be in jail, I imagine.
Back up, don't say that.
No, the approach was different in those days than it is. You know, when I first started coaching, for instance, you didn't go get a drink of water during football practice. You know, you toughed it out. And we fed salt tablets to kids.
Yeah, we were talking about that with Coach Dennison the other day, the conditioning and things of that nature have changed
totally
so much.
Different than it is now, you know. And they were just, your approach was different. We spent a lot of time with, we had much more contact in practice than they have today, and what they do today is probably exactly right. What we did might have been exactly wrong, but that was the nature of the beast, and that's the way you approached it. You figured that was the thing you needed to do to be successful. And you're dealing with different youngsters, and nowadays the youngsters are more aware. They're exposed to so many more things. They have, less things they have more things to involve them in, and plus the fact that in those days, when I started out coaching, every house in the community didn't have air conditioning like it does now. So the youngsters were prepared when they came out for football practice in the beginning of football season. They had been sitting around air conditioning all summer, so you didn't have to condition them in the fashion you do now. It's that simple.
Yep, turn that thermostat to 75.
Yeah,
you know, there's been here within the basketball season the past couple of months. They made issue of it publicly with Coach Rangel at Alleman. They used the old rope-a-dope sideline demeanor.
Mm-hmm.
Sideline demeanor. Now, I've heard that there's another coaching issue that really hasn't been too much public, but I heard sideline demeanor. What about sideline demeanor? What do you mean? You know, I guess, is that one of the issues if you look back? You know, and I think football coaches kind of get a little more benefit of the doubt because they're a little bit further away from the stands. Because I tell you, my lifetime of the 2 years I did sideline stuff at high school football with my son, and I'm not calling anybody out, but I'm saying, I call it heat of the moment. You know, people, I guess, don't understand heat of the moment anymore. And, you know, like the NFL is the cooling off, or the professional sports, which I think is a good idea, is a 15 or 20-minute cooling off period before you talk to the media or whatever. I get that, being up close and personal. But I guess probably if you coached in today's environment, there'd probably be an issue with John Elder's sideline demeanor. People would.
Well, I think if it was the same as it was in 1962 or 3, probably so, yes. Because there was, let's face it, in those days, youngsters had people raise their voice to them more prior to coming to school than they have today. And, you know, it wasn't unusual. That's how you got people's attention, was you need to raise your voice to them. And they responded to that because they need to respond to that at home, so to speak. And another thing, and people tell me this, that I'm wrong in this, but, you know, another thing about that time is when mothers first got involved in following youngsters in sports. Mm-hmm. You know, mothers didn't go to things in those days like they do today, and grandparents didn't have to go to every activity that their grandchildren were involved in and that sort of thing. And so there wasn't the people weren't there to see what was going on, so to speak. Not that we were bad to kids, because we really weren't, but we were more vocal with them than we are today. And that's the nature of education. That's the nature of society today.
Well, and that's the thing. I'm not talking about coaches that are sitting there yelling, calling kids dummies, or, you know, using expletive deletives. I'm talking about just raising their voice and being animated in the course of a high school game that's a heated battle.
Well, you know, going back into that era, even that was the thing that, more so in basketball probably than football, that was the thing that drew many people to the games, was the coaches. And there, you know, the coaches, you take, going back, and I can mention, you know, John Theo at Galesburg and Cheryl Hanks at Quincy, people went to see how they were going to react during the basketball mm-hmm. game as much as they went to see the game. And because they both had success, they both were colorful individuals, and they projected that image throughout the game with officials, with fans, etc., and it was more entertainment, so to speak.
Well, and I think people can't distinguish as well. That's really an interesting observation, and I guess I haven't thought about that from, you know, the grandparents coming and everybody coming to the game, and they're there specifically to watch not the game, but to watch their child play and how they're treated.
Right.
So instead of maybe one person back in the 60s having an issue, I was five or six.
Yeah. Well, just to give you an example, I mean, Monday of this week, we drove 400 miles in one day to watch our grandson run a mile and a half mile in a track meet. That, you know, he just competed. And so people do that today. You know, we spend with our family and with grandkids involved, we spend a lot of time on the road watching them perform.
Yeah, so you want them to run a 15-minute mile then instead of a 6-minute mile, because it's more worthy, or you get more of your time. And I'm just kidding, of course. But that's the thing about, you know, being a grandparent now. I mean, how do you approach that way of life now, of being involved so closely to athletics? And now, I mean, is it just like, hey, I'm an impartial observer, you guys have at it, I'm just here to watch my grandkid?
Well, let's face it, I go to the activities because my grandkids are involved. I watch them as a coach, my wife watches them as a grandmother, let's put it that way, particularly in football. When I go to a football game at any level, I go off totally by myself and to watch the football game, and there's certain things. Now, with Patrick coaching, I have a general idea of what's going to happen, what they're going to do, based on having worked with him and that sort of thing. But in the other cases, that's not the case. But I try to, I look at most games as a coach, most activities they're involved in as a coach.
You know, you talk about kind of the culture chain from the different eras. And the off-season stuff, all right, and this is one of my huge pet peeves, is off-season sports impeding on in-season sports.
Yeah.
And now everybody gives me the argument of, well, we're doing it for those kids that aren't playing another sport, yet those kids in the in-season sport go.
Sure.
I think that's no. You can't do that. And I think still today, though, with the rare exception, most football programs, people understand hands-off.
Yeah.
You're not going to take a football kid and he's going to play in an open basketball gym in the fall.
Right.
I think there are some instances where you're seeing some of that happen. And people can complain and argue about all these participation numbers in various sports, and I think a lot of it, for my opinion, a lot of it has to do with the participation numbers are still high. You're just not seeing the off-season kid that's not playing the winter sport. He's playing a spring sport, but he's doing the off-season during the basketball season or the wrestling season or whatever the fall. He's doing something in the fall where for a winter sport or you know what I mean.
Sure.
The participation is there, but it's the off-season sport they're participating in, not the in-season sport. And I just think that, to me, I don't know what the answer is, but I just think that's a situation where, no, you're not doing it. You use the off season in the summer when there's no school to do your stuff.
Well, another thing it does, it creates division among coaches as well, because some of them expect a total commitment during the, no matter whether their sport's in season or not, they still expect the same commitment out of the youngsters that are involved in another sport as youngsters that aren't involved. Plus the fact that the summer thing particularly, and even during the year, has destroyed family things. You know,
yeah.
You can't plan as a family. You have to take your youngsters away from some activity to do anything as a family. That's the same way with holiday tournaments, so forth. You know, there Thanksgiving tournaments. There weren't any Thanksgiving day Thanksgiving basketball tournaments till the football playoffs started, and then that's when they started. And consequently, the holidays, there's not a holiday season for youngsters anymore that are involved in sports. And in small schools, if you have a young man who's capable or a young lady that's capable of doing something, helping in one sport, they're capable of helping in every sport. And so they need to be involved, but they also need some freedom and some time to do things on their own rather than spend all day in the summer and doing basketball in the morning or football in the afternoon or whatever.
Well, and that's the thing with the contact days, too, that is always interesting during the month of June with the 25 contact days. And I've always thought that it'd be better to have, you know, an A week, a B week, a C week, a D week, or whatever, where A weeks are for basketball and volleyball only, B weeks are for football and whatever other sport and whatever. So it's a alternating type of situation. But again, I think 25 contact days is too much. But my pet peeve, and again, this, I'm not talking about strength and conditioning. I think that's important for all student athletes. I'm talking about the actual individual sport. And again, it's the off-season stuff impeding on the in-season stuff that just, I flip out.
No question about
that. I'm sorry, that's my one issue that I think is the detriment of participation numbers. And I'll continue to argue with anybody. Games have not got better with all the off-season stuff. They have not got better. They just haven't.
That's right.
I mean, it's just still the same product at most of these schools. I haven't noticed anything substantially different from the 90s to the 2000s to 2010, other than the strength of the athlete, those kids that participated in strength and conditioning.
And now then, you know, it's not a different game, but they're playing it differently than they did in those days in football, basketball, et cetera. And they're always dictated by the level above them, so to speak, as to what they try to do. And this is one of my pet peeves as a high school football coach, and some of the things that I observe as a coach on the field that I think are wrong, but coaches listen to college coaches tell them things that they can do, and in many cases, college coaches are poor fundamentalists because they have athletes that can outrun mistakes, and so consequently, they don't teach the technique that's necessary to be used at the high school level because they don't have to worry about that. They're gonna, you know, they can rely more on athleticism because they handpick their youngsters where we take who walks through the door.
So if I went up to John Elder in 1971 and said, and I'm a player for you, and I said, Coach Elder, after practice tonight, I'm going to a open basketball gym, or I'm going to play at some baseball event, or I'm going to an open wrestling room, your response to Jim Taylor would be what?
Well, I guess, Jim, it's
You'd
hard
be in
to,
jail.
It's hard to answer because we didn't have that to contend with.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? We just didn't have that to contend
with.
Well,
and I guess my point is it something that the school... I mean, a school would have to come in, and they're probably not in a position to say, no, we're not going to get into that.
Well, some places do. Some places have, some schools have regular times that you can do certain sports, particularly in the summertime. I mean, particularly their camps, they set them in a specified time period, which makes a difference and separates the two. But what the youngsters need to be involved in as many things as they can be involved in for many reasons. But to try and do all of them at one time is difficult and taxing upon them.
Well, because it's two seasons at one.
That's
I mean,
right.
When you're talking about off season, in season, it's two seasons at one.
Right. And there's you have to have a certain commitment which you make as an athlete. You make a commitment and you want to be as involved as you need to be in the sport at hand. But I guess in defense of the young people, they don't want to upset their coach in the other sport either.
Yeah, that's what it boils down to. All right, John Elder with us. Great to have him in studio. We'll have more in a moment on WRMJ and WRMJ.com.
Sometimes life can feel like a never-ending to-do list. Figuring out what you're going to have for dinner is a task in itself. So planning for your retirement, something that could be 10, 20, or 30 years in the future, is easy to put off. At Country Financial, they get it. And just like your to-do list, they know your needs are unique. They don't believe in taking the cookie-cutter approach to retirement planning. They'll focus on your individual situation and goals to help you create a solid plan for your future. They offer a variety of products and services that help keep you on track. Contact your local Country Financial representative to get started.
Contact your Country Financial representative today. In Aledo, see me, Tracy Bigham,
John Waugh,
or Jason.